This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
For years, there's been an argument, sometimes loud, sometimes subdued, on whether Britain needs an ID card system. One big reason given for wanting one is simply to know who's here legally. With illegal and irregular migration never far from the headlines these days, and with President Macron, during his recent visit, describing the pull factor of illegal migrants being able to work in Britain, the debate is being resurrected. So, what is the history of ID cards in the UK? What form might they take if we have a system? And would they work? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's take a look back at when we did have ID cards in the UK. I'm joined by John Agar, author of The Government Machine, which discusses the history of identity cards. John Agar, we've had ID cards before in this country. Tell us about the first time.
The first time Britain had ID cards was in the First World War. They were introduced in 1916 and really didn't last very long. They were introduced basically to answer a question that came up in an argument in Cabinet about how many fighting men there might be in the country. People had to register. They had to register locally. So there was a local list of who had registered and ID cards were issued against them. But they weren't really tied to anything essential. So people basically forgot them. They got left in pockets and drawers and people very soon forgot they even existed at all.
Right. And then what? When the end of the war, they decided they didn't need them anymore because there was no one to conscript.
That's right. It ended almost as soon as the war ended. So the second time the cards came in, it was for the Second World War in September 1939, so as soon as the war started. And this was a much more substantial system. And indeed, people had learnt from the lessons of the past. They'd learnt why the first card system had failed, and they were determined to make it a much more successful system. The second system was designed to be attached to other purposes. So it was used for three purposes initially, and those were national service, i.e. to mobilise the country into war. It was used for national security and it was used for food rationing. So if you needed to get your food, you'd have to produce your identity card and your ration book to claim a ration. So it made it absolutely essential. If you wanted to eat, you had to have your identity card with you.
Right. And the security aspect was presumably to stop all those German paratroopers dressed as nuns, right?
That's right. Who almost certainly had fake identity cards.
Yes, indeed. So we had these ID cards. Did we get rid of them when the war ended?
No. The second identity card system in Britain lasted as long in peacetime as in wartime. So it lasted from 1945, when the war ended, through to 1952.
We had them until 1952. What happened to stop them?
So for a few years, obviously, we still had rationing, so it was still tied to the rationing system. But as that faded away, and as people saw it as a wartime measure and really didn't want them anymore, there was growing hostility to the ID card system. eventually, what happened was a young man called Clarence Wilcock was stopped in his car by the police, asked for his identity card, and he refused to give it. And this went all the way to the highest courts in the land. And the judge ruled that while this young man should have produced his identity card, the system was not fit for purpose. It was no longer necessary. And essentially, once that judgment had been made, the identity card system was finished.
Is that what the police could do? They could just stop you and say, where's your ID card? Show us who you are.
Yeah. So by 1951, when this happened, the identity card was part of lots of systems of life. And one of those was routine police checks.
So if I'd been walking down the street in 1951 and a policeman didn't like the look of me, could they just sort of say, here, sonny, show us your papers?
He could. If you didn't have it with you, you were given 48 hours to produce it. You had to have it. It's obligatory to have a card, but you didn't actually have to carry it with you all the time. But you were expected to produce it in good order.
Other countries, though, continued with ID cards.
Yeah, no, if you look around Europe, Belgium, for example, has a system of compulsory identity cards where you absolutely can be stopped and asked for it. In many countries, that is also the case. In Britain, it's fair to say that the identity card system was seen as something more likely to be found in continental Europe. It was seen in that way as being un-British. The opponents of identity cards would often make that point, that this is a system that the Prussians might have, or the Germans, or the Belgians, but it wasn't suitable for the Brits.
And all those wartime escape films where you're coming off the train and you're asked for your papers by the Gestapo.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great Daily Mail column from about 1950 where they say literally that. Being asked to produce your identity card is like being asked by a Gestapo agent to produce your papers.
To what extent did we then revisit the idea of ID cards in subsequent years?
The idea of ID cards has never gone away. So it's been part of war plans, for example. It's been quite a few times proposed, usually as a response to the moral panic of the day. So where there's a big hot issue, and say in the 1980s that might be football hooliganism, later it's things like benefit fraud. In the late 1980s, again, there's a lot of clamour for identity cards, often from the press rather than from politicians, but they do take a serious look at it. The reason it stopped is because it would never work in Northern Ireland. They realised that asking people to carry essentially a symbol of the state would not work in certain communities in Northern Ireland. But it comes back in the 1990s. So Michael Howard, who's the Home Secretary under John Major, he becomes extremely keen on identity cards in 1993. He thinks it is a solution to any number of problems, and these include things like benefit fraud, immigration issues, and so on, and really starts pushing identity cards in cabinet. Howard pushes this enough to float it as a consultation paper. If it hadn't been, I think, for the election in 1997, quite possibly it would have been introduced under John Major.
Right. So there was almost a scheme under John Major. You then get the 1997 election. Labour's elected. What happens then?
Under Tony Blair, what happens is 9/11. In 9/11, when David Blunkett was the Home Secretary, immediately he starts saying what the country needs is a strong identity card system, because only then potential terrorists could be identified. That's where the push under New Labour starts for identity cards.
And how far do they get?
There's a lot of opposition. Identity cards have always been a divisive issue. So there's a lot of fighting about the merits of the identity card system. Should it be voluntary? Should it be compulsory? Is it needed at all? Is it just too expensive? What can it solve? Can it even solve the things that the proponents say an identity card system should solve? So it takes a lot of argument, but eventually a voluntary identity card system is indeed brought in and is rolled out for a few months before the 2010 election. And then when the new coalition government comes in, the identity card and all the database that's behind it is ditched.
John Agar. So that's the history, but which countries already have ID cards? Rainer Kartl is Professor of Innovation and Public Governance at UCL. He's from Estonia, a country which introduced digital ID cards more than 20 years ago. Rainer Kartl, can you tell us how Estonia went about getting its digital ID card?
Well, Estonia has, since 2002 actually, we have an identity card that now has become pretty much the standard for how the European identity card looks as well. If you go to Finland or Austria, they have a similar sort of style to Estonian one, I think, because it was the first of its class. And also from the very beginning, it has this sort of electronic component. So imagine your bank cards, how they used to be. So you have to put your bank card into an ATM machine because there is a chip. That's how Estonian ID cards looks from 2002, actually, from the very beginning, because the idea was not to only to have ID card, but to have it digitally enabled so you can log into services, but also log into private services like banks, for instance. And of course, what Estonia has done and developed on top of that is that now it's in your mobile phone as well. So I don't need to have my physical card with me at all. So I can sort of use an essentially like an app kind of way to log into all services. As an Estonian, I have access to 3,000 services, both public and private.
Right. So that's probably the most compendious ID card system anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, probably you would now have to say India is very similar because it's based on kind of similar idea that you have a physical card that has a strong electronic component.
Under what circumstances in Estonia would you be obliged to use or show this ID card?
Well, actually, if you want to use anything online, you have to use it. So it is in that sense mandatory. You can't do anything without the ID card.
So what can the authorities ask of you with regard to the production of the ID card? For example, if you need to register with a doctor's or you need hospital treatment, are you going to be asked to produce this?
Yeah. I mean, you're asked not only to produce it, but you're asked to slot it into the machine, actually, like an ATM kind of small machine.
Like a card?
Card reader, exactly. So if I would go to a pharmacy, I just put it in and they would see my prescriptions. It sort of connects at that time my medical records with my GP and the pharmacy.
But now it's on the phone. What do you
have? Now it's on the phone, yeah. But for the phone, it's essentially you can sign every document over phone. So you don't really need physical documents at all, which is really the standard in Estonia. You wouldn't really see papers. If you buy something like a house or if you go to a GP, you don't really see paper records anymore.
So when does your ID card start? Does it start at birth?
Yeah, exactly. You're essentially given an ID number at birth. There is like an office that gives you a number. You go out of the hospital with a number. And that, of course, if anything's a number, it can be digital.
Right. So what about things like voting? Would you use this for voting?
Yes, and that's probably the more controversial end of things. Yes, you can. I live in UK. I vote regularly in Estonia. I have done over essentially a website. About 30-35% of all the votes are given electronically.
Okay. Now, Estonia was part of the Soviet Union. Yeah. And I suppose I'd imagined that as a consequence, the population there would be rather averse to this form of information gathering. Can you take me through how the debate about these ID cards developed?
Yeah, you have to sort of think back to 1990s in many ways. Of course, we just came out of the Soviet Union, very oppressive regime, a lot of big prototype of surveillance things. On the other hand, we were also entering digital revolution. And I think for Estonia at that time, for a political and economic elite, sort of this leapfrogging, jumping on the digital bandwagon, was seen as essentially a warm form of freedom, but also a form of economic success. There was a small sort of elite able to convince people, this is a good thing. It gives you easy access to services. You can pay your taxes in 5 minutes, which is still true. You can access your health records. But we're also making it very secure.
So there wasn't any significant opposition to...
No, not at all. Not at that point. I think the opposition really came only around voting. And that's been not even opposition, but it was more like politicization of that issue. Because if you imagine, look back like 15 years ago, and voting goes digital, of course, younger, more liberal-leaning people used it more than, let's say, older people who don't maybe want to access and maybe are more conservative as well.
Now, those other European countries that have got ID cards, have they also gone digital?
By now, I think since last year, actually, most EU countries and their ID cards have a digital layer. So they have a chip in it that can be read by a machine. And ID cards also have increasingly biometric data on it. So your fingerprints, your irises would be on there for machines to read, to recognize you, to make sure this is you.
So that's for your own security.
Exactly. And EU is moving towards that direction quite slowly, but still moving.
And finally, let's look at the other example you gave, which is India. I mean, India is a country where large numbers of the people don't have access, sometimes even to sewage or to running water. And yet they are now expected to have a digital ID card.
Yeah, and then 900 million of them have. So it's like the amazing feat, I think, is really India compared to Estonia, which is very small and quite homogeneous country, actually. India, of course, huge country, huge differences. But of course, also that can be a real driver, if you say. We want to do one thing really well. We want to identify people. We want to give them bankability, that they can have bank cards, that they can earn money, and that they can be identified for government support.
Rainer Kartl.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: Startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Before we carry on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one which asks how close the UK is getting to the EU and the one which looks at ransomware attacks. Back now to ID cards, and I want to find out what an identity card for the UK might look like. I'm joined by Edgar Whitley, who's Professor of Information Systems in the Department of Management at LSE, and Rachel Caldicott, a technology specialist and executive director of the research consultancy Careful Industries. Edgar Whitley, the French government apparently believes that the UK is weakened by not having an ID card, but are there any domestic proposals currently to have one?
There's actually at least two major initiatives that are in place at the moment. One for accessing government services, which is called One Login, and then a private sector option that is used for all sorts of private sector activities, particularly at the moment, proving your right to work and proving your right to rent. So those are the two that exist for UK nationals at the moment.
Where's those two come from?
One Login has been created and run by the government through the Government Digital Service. The right to work, right to rent checks are being provided by private sector companies. Both of those initiatives are now being managed by a single government department, the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology.
Right, they're both in the same place, but they are actually separate and they're both not compulsory. They're both completely voluntary, I imagine.
Yes. If you have to do online tax returns, become a company director, et cetera, you need to use the One Login service to prove who you are. If you want to prove your right to work or right to rent, and you want to do that potentially digitally, say you're a remote worker, then you would use one of the private sector initiatives.
Rachel, what are the current broader arguments for everybody to have an ID card that are bubbling under here in Britain?
What we've seen in the last 5 years is that some of the political ghosts of the past that Tony Blair was involved in have come back. And there are two thoughts about why compulsory ID might help. One of them is like the idea that if we know what's happening with everyone and we have better data, then you're able to do better economic forecasting, you're better able to run government. And there's another proposal, which is that digital ID would help limit the number of people arriving in the UK.
I want to come on specifically to the question about how ID cards or presentation ID fits into the question of migration and immigration a little bit later. But Rachel, you've done polling on the area of what people actually believe and what the British public believe and why they believe it. Are you saying that what you're picking up from that is they quite like it from the point of view of utility, or are you picking up from that they quite like it from the point of view of security?
So the thing that we found is that there's a big split, particularly in age. So people aged 18 to 54 are broadly interested in convenience, particularly younger people who are moving house, moving jobs, who are suddenly having to do grown-up things they haven't had to do previously, you know. But the people who are older, particularly people over 60, are particularly interested in ID from a more law and order perspective. What really came out in our polling is they were the least likely to be interested in carrying ID themselves, but they wanted to know who everybody else was and where they were, right? And so there's two completely different things happening here. The other thing that's interesting is particularly younger people are very worried about what ID means in terms of rights, inclusion, policing.
So you're broadly saying that the reasons why old people like ID cards are not the reasons young people do, and the reasons young people might be suspicious of ID cards are the reasons older people like them.
yes, basically.
Now, I presume, Edgar, that the current arguments for an ID card are not based so much on the utility arguments that the younger voters like, but more on the arguments which convince the older voters. Can you just take us through why there might be pressure for ID cards at the moment?
So there's certainly a political pressure for ID with the concerns about illegal immigration being enabled through illegal employment. So there's been a proposal supported by Labour Together, which is a political think tank closely associated with the Labour Party, and particularly with backbench MPs. Their proposal is to introduce a Brit card, which will be a digital ID. In the first instance, it will be there to allow everybody to prove their right to work and their right to rent, building on the government's one login ID system. And of course, that has to become mandatory, because otherwise you go along and say, oh, I've got a right to work, I just don't have a Brit card.
So their argument is for this to work, it has to be everybody. You can't just kind of make it voluntary in the way they want. Rachel, can we just look in principle at the problems that there would be with making sure that everybody did have access to such a thing digitally? I mean, are there still large numbers of people in the country who frankly are offline?
Yes. What we see is there are three different types of ways that people are not digitally included. One of them is economically, you know, they can't afford it. One of them is they don't have the skills. And the other is they just aren't bothered. So there's a relatively small number of older people who are resolutely offline. I think there's a more interesting group of older people who do digitally engaged, but they don't want to do everything in their life on the phone. If we look at all of those people together, it's about 15% of the country.
Rachel, do you think privacy is less of an issue than it was last time round?
We're obviously in a completely different world generally now, thinking about the amount of data people are just giving away constantly. There's a lot that many people are happy to trade for convenience, but it's a more complex argument now. And I think that we definitely saw in our research that people 55 to 65 were a lot more worried about privacy than younger groups.
Let's talk about now the big issue which seems to have impelled this right to the front of the agenda, which is migration and security. The French believe that a pull factor for migrants crossing the Channel is easier access to illegal working in the UK. This, of course, has nothing to do with people on boats per se. It has to do with any illegal migrants, including people who overstay their visas, which is quite a large number of people. Edgar, couldn't you create an ID card and insist that employers check the ID cards and run spot checks on them to make sure they're doing it?
Yeah, and you can insist that everyone follows the law and do spot checks on every single activity that they do so that you make sure that everyone's a law-abiding society. And that actually comes back to one of the privacy issues around how the technology operates. So if you have an ID that can confirm that you have the right to work in the UK, and your employer checks that and says, I've done a check and I now have confidence that this person is entitled to work, what kind of records do you then need to keep? Because you've done a legitimate ID check. Do you keep a local record? Do you send it off to the Home Office? Do you send it off to the insurance company? I mean, there's lots of ways in which that data, who was checked, whatever, could be shared with other kinds of people.
But isn't the objective here to get the employer to find out that the person who's applying for the job has not got a legitimate ID and then therefore to refuse them employment? Isn't that what it's aimed at doing?
That's what it's aiming at. But of course, you still have to have had all the people who've got a legitimate right to work having the ID. But until you've got everybody in that position, you're going to go with the, well, I've got some documents, I've got some papers, etc. Or, of course, the big element is those companies that are not actually doing the checking. And people know the kinds of industries, the kinds of sectors where those things are happening.
Rachel, what's the Home Office currently saying about all this?
If we just think back to earlier when Edgar was talking about what is happening in terms of digital ID at the moment, there are two programs happening in one government department. And then the Home Office is kind of doing its own thing. We've had at Christmas, visas replaced the previous paper card for people who don't hold the UK passport. They launched and then unlaunched because they weren't working. And then they like slowly rolled out again.
So we do have e-visas now.
Yes, but they don't always work, and they don't always work in that they don't then interoperate with DWP, HMRC.
Department of Work and Pensions.
Yes, yeah.
Is the Home Office essentially interested in going towards what you might call an ID card, except just for migrants?
Well, then you come back to the same problem, that it's not mandatory for everybody. And then you go, well, do you look... Literally, do you look like a migrant? So it has to be for everybody. Otherwise, you get all sorts of either actual discrimination or perceptions of discrimination.
Okay, I'm going to put back to you, given what we've heard earlier from Rainer Kartl about what's happened in Estonia and in India, that actually some other countries have managed this process, Edgar.
Yeah, Estonia is a very, very small country. India's not. So it's moving in the right kind of direction, but you have huge examples of people still being excluded because the technology doesn't work.
Rachel, to try and draw the discussion to a conclusion, the one thing that we may have learned from what's gone before in this programme is that if you're going to make an ID card system or ID system work, you have to make it useful to people. And you've talked about how young people can be made to feel that an ID card system is useful. Do you think that people will endorse an ID card system the more that you make it useful? In other words, by doing these voluntary things in the first instance, you'll get people used to the idea.
Yeah. And so if we look at what has happened over the last 20 years, the reason such a lot of people had a smartphone phones is because we can do loads of things on them, right? And the interesting thing to do now is to try a number of things, see how people use them and allow those things to evolve rather than basically saying as of October the 9th, everything is different. We had maybe that moment in COVID when that happened. But if we think about what needed to happen to make everybody do the paperwork, get the pass, it was enormous and extraordinary. And I think a better, more human approach is to allow ID to roll out and change with us over time.
Edgar, Rachel said what she would prefer, but I suppose my question is kind of even beyond what you or Rachel might prefer and what it is the government may do.
What's really interesting is that those two schemes that I talked about both use the same standards, the same rules for proving ID. So if you want both a private sector ID and a one login account, you have to provide the same evidence. So there's a really interesting tension, shall we say, particularly as both are in the same government department, as to should the private sector IDs allow you to access government services and therefore save the government a huge amount of money by not having one login running anymore? Or should you be able to use your one login account to do all of these things that private sector services are providing and also kill off all of the entrepreneurial startups that have been developing digital ID solutions in the UK? And that's the decision that the ministers need to be thinking about.
Do you see these as the incremental steps that get us ready for the big one, for the big national ID?
If we've got these things, then it will be the gateway. I remain concerned about all the practical challenges before the solution then becomes magical and solves everything.
Well, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Edgar Whitley and Rachel Caldicott, and also to John Agar and Rainer Kartl. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirstine Knight and Sally Abrahams. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeley. The sound engineers were James Beard and Neil Churchill. The editors were Bridget Harney and Sam Bonham. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
When you look at what's going on around the world, it's easy to think that we humans are incapable of living peacefully. But there are out there people who disagree.
I keep going because someone has to hold the line between grief and revenge.
I'm Matthew Side, and in my Sideways mini-series, Chasing Peace, from BBC Radio 4, I'm meeting people who have radical ideas about how we can stop what feels like an inevitable slide into conflict. Listen first on BBC Sounds.